shouts another man, gladly by the bar. He pushes off a bar stool to come closer, barrel-chested and ginger-haired. He smells like garlic and beer.
The hen among the cocks!
Brian takes my arm, not gently, and gestures with his other hand to the back of the pub. Then he turns to the man and says,
It sure is. So now, John, what do you think of this tide coming in? Due for a storm?
I know a rescue effort when I see one, so I push farther into the pub, away from them. I search the back of the pub, and there, in the corner booth, is Gabe. He's leaned forward, a pint in front of him, long fingers spread like a spider on the table, as he makes some point. When he laughs, even without hearing him, his expression looks looser and coarser than I remember. Anger snakes through me. Brian's still covering for me, so I surge through the smoke and stand beside Gabe's chair at his shoulder. I wait for him to notice me. Tommy Fork, damnable co-conspirator, across the table has already seen me and smiled prettily. But Gabe keeps gesturing. Gabe, I say. I feel, annoyingly, like a child standing at the arm of Dad's chair, interrupting him from reading the paper. He turns. I can't tell if his expression is guilty. Now that I look, I don't think it is at all. He says just this.
Oh, Puck.
Yes.
Oh, Puck.
I can't believe you're riding in the races,
Tommy breaks in. He has two empty glasses in front of him, and so all of the words become one effortless word. No real pauses, just S sounds between them.
Saw you there that first day. First girl ever. Here's to us.
Don't encourage her,
Gabe says, but he's jovial. His breath smells like alcohol.
You're drunk, I say.
Gabe glances at Tommy, then back to me.
Don't be stupid, Kate. It's one drink.
Dad didn't want you to drink. You told him you wouldn't.
You're being hysterical.
But I don't feel hysterical.
I need to talk to you.
Okay.
Gabe doesn't move. The way he's sitting, I can tell that he's very aware of Tommy watching, and he's working the conversation to make himself look clever. I lean over to say,
privately.
The thing that is hurting me the most is the look on his face. One eyebrow raised, as if he still thinks that I'm overreacting. He lifts one palm toward the ceiling.
There isn't really a place to be private here. Can't it hold?
I put my hand on his arm and grip his shirt.
No. Not anymore.
I need to talk now.
I guess I'm going, Tommy.
I'll be back.
You show him, Puck,
Tommy says, with a fist punch into the air. Right at that moment, I despise Tommy and every bit of prettiness about him. I don't even look at him. Instead, I lead Gabe toward the door at the very back of the pub. It's a tiny toilet that smells a little like recent vomit. I shove the door shut behind him. I wish I had a moment to collect my thoughts, to remember exactly how I wanted to confront him, but I seem to have shut everything I wanted to say outside of the room.
This is cozy, Gabe says.
A mirror the size of a book is hung above the sink, and I'm glad I can't see myself in it.
Where have you been?
Gabe eyes me as if the question is a ridiculous one.
Working.
Working? All the time? All night?
Gabriel shifts his weight, stares at the ceiling.
I haven't been gone all night. Is that all this is about?
It wasn't all it was about, but I can't remember what exactly it was that I was going to shout at him. My thoughts are scattered and gritty underneath my feet. I can only remember clearly my desire to hit him in the eye, and then all of a sudden, the most important thing comes back to me.
Benjamin Malvin came to the house this week.
Hmm.
Hmm? He said he's going to take the house.
Ah.
Ah? Why didn't you tell us?
I ask. I hate that I'm still clutching his arm, but how do I know that he won't leave without my fingers on him?
How could I?
Gabe replies. He's dismissive.
Finn would go crazy and fret himself to death, and you would become hysterical. I would not, I snap.
I'm not sure if I'm hysterical right now. Everything I've said seems logical to me, but my voice feels a little out of control.
Clearly.
We deserve to be told, Gabriel.
What good would it do?
You two weren't going to make any more money.
What do you think I've been doing all these nights?
I'm doing my best.
And then you're leaving. My brother looks at me, and his smile has vanished. What replaces it isn't unhappiness. Just no expression at all. Eyes narrowed against a wind I don't feel. I can't appeal to the feelings of this Gabe, because I can't tell if he has any.
A person can only try so hard. I did my best.
That's not good enough, I say.
He removes his sleeve from my fingers and opens the door. The sound and smell of the pub swell into the airless room.
That's too bad. It's all I've got.
Gabe shuts the door behind himself. I swallow my sadness as hard as I can. It only makes it halfway down my throat. It's all up to me. That's what it comes down to. I spend a long few minutes in the bathroom after he's gone, my forehead resting against the doorframe. I can't go out right away, because then Tommy Fork will grin at me and make some stupid joke, and I'll burst into tears in public, and I'm just not going to do that. I know that Brian Carroll is probably still waiting at the front of the pub for me, and I'm sorry about that, but not sorry enough to come out. After a bit, I take a deep breath. I guess I thought before that somehow I could convince Gabe to stay, that somehow, through all this, he would change his mind. But it feels undeniable now. It feels like he's already stepped onto the boat. I slip out of the bathroom and find there's a back door a few feet away from it. Two great decisions battle inside me for a moment. Go up front, past Gabe and Tommy Fork and the staring men to where Brian Carroll maybe still waits, or slide out the back door into the alley to lick my wounds and bide my time until the riders parade.
Really? I just want to go home and crawl into my bed and put my pillow over my head until December or March.
I could eat my shame for dinner. It's so thick. But I take the back door and leave Brian Carroll behind. The wind tears down the narrow, stone-walled alley behind the pub, and as I head back to the street, I think crossly of hot chocolate and home that doesn't feel like home anymore. I can see that there's an even denser sea of people on the street now, and I'm feeling not at all motivated to swim in it at the moment. Then I hear,
"Puck!"
And it's Finn's voice. He grabs my elbow, unsteady, and for a brief, uncertain moment, I think Finn is drunk, because I can believe anything of my brother's now. But then I see that he was just shoved from behind by the seething crowd. Finn finds my left hand, opens my fingers, and puts a November cake in my palm. It oozes honey and butter, rivulets of the creamy frosting joining the honey in the pit of my hand. It begs to be licked. Someone nearby screams like a water horse. My heart goes like a rabbit's. I let the cake drip and meet Finn's eyes. He's a stranger, a black demon with a ghastly white grin. It takes me a moment to properly recognize him beneath the charcoal and chalk striped across his cheeks. Only his lips are pink, where the frosting from his own November cake has rubbed him clean. He wears one of the false spears made of driftwood on his back, secured with a leather thong.
"How did you get that?"
I have to shout to be heard over the mob. Finn grabs my other hand and stuffs something into it. When I go to open my fist to see what it is, he pushes my arm closer to my body, shielding it from general view. My eyes blink at the wad of money in my palm. Finn leans toward me. His breath is sweet as nectar. He's had more than one cake.
"I sold the Morris."
I hurriedly shove the money out of sight.
"Who gave you that much for it?"
"A silly tourist woman who thought it was cute."
He smiles at me, teeth crooked and bright in his coal-black face, his hair crazy, and I feel my face soften into a grin.
Thought you were cute, probably.
Finn's smile disappears. One of the lines in Finn's code is that you're not to say anything about Finn being attractive to the opposite sex. I'm not sure which exact statute governs this, but it's closely related to the one that won't let you thank him. Something about compliments and Finn don't work.
Never mind, I say.
Good job.
Only thing, Finn says, licking his hand, is I'm not sure how we're getting home now.
If I make it through the Riders' Parade, I reply, I'll fly us home.
Chapter 30 Sean. The Scorpio drums pound a ragged heartbeat as I wind my way through the crowds that fill the streets of Skarmouth. The cold air smarts as I breathe it in. The wind carries all sorts of foreign scents. Food that's only made during the race season. Perfume only women from the mainland wear. Hot pitch, burning rubbish. Beer spilled on the stones. This Skarmouth is raw and hungry. Striving and unknowable. Everything the races make me feel on the inside is bleeding up through the seams in the street tonight. In front of me, people shoulder their way through the tourists, who are slow with drink and loud with excitement. If you hold yourself a certain way, though, even the drunk will part for you. I slide through the crowd toward the butchers, my eyes wide open. I'm watching for Mutt Malvern. It's better to see than be seen, until I know what he is up to tonight.
Sean Kendrick.
I hear my name, whispered, then called, but I keep walking. There are many who'll recognize my face tonight. As I walk, I look past the people at the town that stands beneath them. The stones are gold and red in the streetlights, the shadows black and brown and deep death blue, all the colors of the November ocean. Bicycles lie up against the walls as if a wave has washed them there and then retreated. Girls push by me, their strides ringing from the bells tied around their ankles. Firelight flickers from one of the side streets, flames licking from a barrel, boys gathered around it. I look at Skarmouth, and it looks back at me, its eyes wild. On one of the walls, there's an advertisement for the Malvern Yard. Four-time winner of the Scorpio races, it says. Own a piece of the races. Young stock auction on Thursday at 7 a.m. Everything in that advertisement is my business, but my name is nowhere on it. I have to stop for the drummers as they crash up from a side street that leads to the water. They're 14 strong, driven by enthusiasm rather than talent. They all wear black. The Scorpio drums are wide as the span of my arms, the heads made of blood-spattered leather and rope. The drums throb, replacing my pulse with theirs. Behind the drummers is a woman who wears a horse's head and a blood-red tunic. A tail curls behind her, and it's hard to tell if it is rope or hide or a real tail. Her feet are bare by tradition. It is impossible to tell who she is. The drums thump by and we press against the walls to allow them to pass. Some of the tourists clap. The locals stomp. The mare goddess scans the crowd slowly, the stuffed horse head dwarfing her body. I see someone make the sign of a cross over the front of them and then, again, backward this time. In the center of the street, the horse-headed woman holds out her hand, and 1,000 tiny pebbles rain out across the street. By tradition, she'll drop a single shell in the course of the night, and whoever gets the mare goddess's shell will have a wish. There is nothing but sand in her hand this time. One night, many years ago, as I stood beside my father, she looked at me and dropped her handful of sand and pebbles, and the single shell spun across the ground in front of me. I had darted away from my father's side to catch the shell where it stopped. I had my wish formed before my fingers curled around it. I turn my face to the side, waiting for the woman to pass, waiting for the memory to pass. I hear an exhalation, at once human and equine, and I turn my head. The Mare Goddess stands directly in front of me, inches away. The great old grey head is turned so that the left eye regards me, like Kor would have with his one poor eye. Only this horse's eye has been replaced with a shiny bit of slate, polished so that it winks and weeps like the piebald's. This close, I can see the streaks of darker red in the woman's tunic, where the fabric wrinkled and caught more blood in the folds. The costume is fearfully made. Even close, it's hard to tell how the woman ends and the false head begins, and it's impossible to determine how she can see. I imagine I feel hot breath on my face, huffing from the nostrils. My heart speeds. I'm once again a boy, and I'm watching her hand open, releasing pebbles and sand. The island, the beach, life stretches before me. The Mare Goddess seizes my chin with her hand. The shale eye stares at me. The hair around it is matted with age, too long since death.
"Sean Kendrick,"
she says, and the voice is throaty, barely human. I hear the sea in it.
"Did you get your wish?"
I cannot look away. "Yes, many times over." The shale glints and blinks. The voice again takes me by surprise.
"Has it brought you happiness?"
The question is not one that I would normally consider. I'm not unhappy. Happiness isn't something this island yields easily. The ground is too rocky and the sun too sparse for it to flourish. "Well enough?" Her fingers are tight, tight, tight on my jaw. I smell blood and I see now that fresh blood, soaked into the shirt, has dripped onto her hands.
"The ocean knows your name, Sean Kendrick,"
she says.
"Make another wish."
She reaches up and smears the back of her hand across both of my cheekbones. Then the Mare Goddess turns away to follow the drummers. Just a woman in a dead horse's head. But there is something hollow inside me, and for the first time, winning doesn't feel like enough. I can't get the Mare Goddess out of my head. The timbre of her voice, the imagined feel of her breath on my skin. My throat burns as if I've swallowed seawater. I swim now through the crowd, from my encounter with the Mare Goddess and back into the real world. I pin myself to the ground with the memory of my ordinary errand at Grattan's. I need to settle up the account, and I need to place another order for the water horses. But my mind keeps turning over the woman in the horse head, trying to decide whose hands they could have been. If I can place her, I can fill the void inside me. It becomes only a parlor game again, then, if I know whose voice it was, made gritty inside the dead skull. I think it may have been Peg Grattan, no stranger to blood on her hands, and no taller than me, even with the horse head on. I push into the butcher's. As always, it's the cleanest place in Skarmouth, and it's lit to a bright daylight white inside. Two birds have somehow gotten into the building, and as I press my way in, the lights seem to flicker and dim as their wings flash in front of the bulbs. I don't see Peg Grattan behind the counter, so it could have been her in the horse costume. I feel lighter, less cold. I stand at the counter and Beach Grattan sullenly takes my order. It's not me he resents, but the job, keeping him in when he wants out to the festival.
"Your face is a ruin," Beach grunts with admiration, and I remember the woman smearing my face with blood. "You look like the devil."
I don't reply.
"I'll be out of here in 20 minutes, he tells me, though I didn't ask.
30,
calls Peg Grattan from the back. I taste blood in my mouth. An eye made of shale blinks at me. Beach jots down my order, and as he does, I look up at the board behind the counter. There is my name and cause, and beside us are our current odds, 1 to 5. Below us are also the names of a score of new entrants from the mainland who have found mounts in the first few days of training. They'll crowd the beach bad as the first day of training, inept and overbrave. I scan down the list to find Kate Connolly. I see her pony's name first, and then her name. Her odds are 45-1. I wonder how much of that is because of her pony, and how much is because of her gender. I let my eyes trail down the list to find Mutt's name on the list. There it is, and his horse is beside it. By all rights, the name written beside his should have been Adana, the horse that he has not touched for 2 days, the bay with white markings, the horse that I told his father to put him on. But it doesn't say Adana. The word printed beside Mutt's is Scarter, a good name for a horse, hard and short. Scarter is a local name for the magpie, a bird known for its cleverness, for its affection for shiny things, for its black and white coloration. There's only one thing on that beach that's black and white. Scarter is the piebald mare. Chapter 31. Sean. I find him by one of the bonfires. The flames strive high into the black sky, tangled with the night. I can taste the smoke on my tongue. Matthew Malvern, I say, and it comes out a snarl, a call to battle, no more friendly than one of Kaur's screams across the sand. Mutt is a giant, a mythical creature outlined in black before the bonfire, charcoal in one hand and a scrap of paper in the other, a sea wish. If he has a face, I cannot see it. I shout, "Is it a death wish you have written on that?" Mutt twists the paper just long enough for me to see my name on it, written backward. Then he lets it fly over the edge of the cliff. It disappears into the black. "That horse will kill you." Mutt swaggers up to me. His breath is dark, the underside of the sea. "And when, Sean Kendrick, have you ever cared for my safety?" He stands closer and closer until our shadow is the same. I don't flinch. If he means to fight tonight, I mean to fight him back. The storm's inside me already, and I can see Fundamental go under again, fresh as the minute it happened. "It might not be you she kills," I say. "And no one deserves to die because of you." The fire is hot on my skin. "I know why you don't want me on her," Mutt laughs. "You know she's faster than him." For so many years I've taken every precaution to keep Mutt alive for his father. Put him on the safest horse I can manage, trained the hell out of that horse to make it impervious to the ocean, watched him in training to make sure that no one else interfered with him. I have 2 healed ribs that should be his. Now he's put himself so far outside my ability to protect him that it's almost relieving. On the piebald, I can do nothing for him. I put my hands up. "Do what you want. I'm done." I see figures at the corner of my eye. They're here to bring us over for the riders' parade. The night's nearly over, and then the training really begins. It's hard to imagine, right now, a day after this night, which seems like it could go on forever. "Yes," Mutt says. "You are."
Chapter 32. Puck. The Riders' Parade is not really a parade at all. There's a man calling over the crowd. "Riders! Riders! To the rock!" He clearly means for us to follow him. I keep waiting for it to sort itself out into something more organized, but it never does. The only time it looks anything like a parade, kind of, is when I spy a few of the riders all heading in the same direction, up to the cliff top. The crowd parts for them, and I hurry after them, Finn trailing as best he can. No one moves for me, however, so I get a mouthful of wayward shoulders and a ribcage full of elbows. By now, it's blacker than black, and the only light comes from 2 bonfires, one burning high and furious, and the other smaller and spitting. I'm not certain where I should be.
Kate Connolly, someone says,
not in a nice way. When I turn my head, I see nothing but eyes glancing away and eyebrows pulled together. It's a strange thing, to be talked about instead of talked to. A hand grabs my arm and I turn, hissing and spitting, until I see that it's Elizabeth, Dory Maud's sister. Her hair is fair, even in this dim light, and she's wearing a red frock, the colour of Father Mooneyham's car. She makes a sour face. Her lips match Father Mooneyham's car, too. I'm sort of surprised to see her here. I've never seen her outside of the booth, or Fathom and Sons, and I thought, possibly, that she would melt or disintegrate if she crossed into the real world. Each of the sisters has her realm. Dory Maud's is the widest, including the whole island, and then Elizabeth's is the building and booth, and then Annie's is the smallest of all, only the second floor of Fathom and Sons.
You were lost, aren't you? Dory Maud said you wouldn't lose your way, but I knew you would.
Elizabeth's expression is pure disdain. Lost means I know where I'm going, I snap. I've never been to the parade before.
Don't bite me, Elizabeth says. It's this way. Finn, boy, are you catching midges? Close your mouth and come on.
Her fingers are claws in my upper arm as she guides me up, up, up to the cliff above the racing beach. Finn trots after us, as twitchy as a puppy.
Where is Dory? I shout. Gambling, snarls Elizabeth. Of course, while I do the work.
I'm not certain how guiding me to the top of the cliff counts as work, but I'm grateful for it. I'm also not certain I can imagine Dory Maud betting on the horses.
Certainly not in any way that justified Elizabeth snarled, of course.
I do my best to imagine Dory Maud in the butcher's, placing a bet, but the best I can imagine is her and the black-eyed girl. In my imaginings, she manages it better than I do, swaggering up to the bar like a man. Elizabeth snaps at me to wake up and propels me with great confidence through the crowd at the cliff top. Only after several long minutes does she stop to catch her bearings, but I can see now that we're in the right place, because I spot a point of stillness in the seething crowd. Sean Kendrick. His clothing is dark, his expression darker, and he looks off into the black night in the direction of the sea. He is unmistakably waiting. There, I say.
No, says Elizabeth, following my gaze. That is not where you're headed. I think the race is dangerous enough without that, don't you? This way.
Sean turns his head just as Elizabeth jerks me in the opposite direction, and our eyes meet. There's something sharp and unprotected in his expression, and then I have to look down to keep Elizabeth from hauling me off my feet. Finn scoots up beside me, hands shoved in his pockets against the cold. He casts a doleful look toward Elizabeth. I turn my head and whisper to him, "You'd think this is the race by the speed she's going." Finn doesn't smile, but his eyes do. Then Elizabeth comes to a halt.
"Here," she says.
We've come around to a third bonfire, and before it is a great flat rock, splattered and streaked with brown. It takes me a moment to understand what I'm seeing. It's old, old blood, stained all over the rock. Finn's face is pinched. There's a huge crowd of people circling the rock, waiting as Sean was waiting, and already I recognize a few of the riders a short distance away. Dr. Horsell, Tommy Falk, Mutt Malvern, Ian Privett. Some of them are talking and laughing with each other. They've done this before. And there's a sense of familiarity. I feel suddenly ill. "What's the blood from?" I whisper to Elizabeth.
"Puppies," Elizabeth says.
She's caught Ian Privett looking at her, and she bares her teeth at him in something that I don't think is supposed to be a smile. Taking me by both my upper arms, she holds me in front of her like a shield.
"It's the riders. You'll go up and put a drop of your blood on there to show you're riding."
I stare at the rock. That's a lot of blood for just a drop from each rider over the years. Now a man's climbed onto the rock. I recognize him as Frank Eaton, a farmer my father knew. He's wearing one of the weird traditional scarf things that the tourists like to buy. It wraps over his shoulder and pins at his hip and looks utterly ridiculous with his corduroy trousers. I have a very strong association of sweat smell with the traditional costume, and he doesn't look like he will change that impression. Holding a small bowl in his hands, Eaton shouts to the crowd, which is a little quieter now.
It falls to me to speak for the man who will not ride.
Eaton tips the bowl, and blood splashes down over the rock at his feet. He doesn't stand back, and so drops of it missed his pants. I don't think he minds.
Rider without a name, he says. Horse without a name. By his blood.
Sheeps, Elizabeth says.
Or maybe horse. I don't remember.
That's barbaric. I'm aghast. Finn looks like he may throw up. Elizabeth shrugs just one shoulder. Ian Privet watches her do it.
50 years ago, it was a man they killed up there, just like every year before. The man who will not ride.
Why? I demand. Her voice is bored. There's a real answer, possibly, but she's not interested in knowing it.
Because men like to kill things. Good thing they stopped. We'd run out of men.
Because, cuts in a voice that I recognize instantly, if you feed the island blood before the race, maybe she won't take as much during it. Elizabeth turns to Peg Grattan with a sour look. I blink at Peg. She's barely recognizable under her elaborate headdress. It looks a little like one of the scary tufted puffins that you can sometimes find on the island. It has a great pointed visor that forms the beak, and ropey yellow tassels that come off over each ear like long horns. I search for signs of Peg's curly hair, but it's hidden securely under the fabric lining of the headdress. Don't expect them to be friendly to you, Puck, Peg Grattan tells me, as if Elizabeth's not there. A lot of them consider a girl on the beach bad luck. They won't be happy to see you. I press my lips together.
I don't need them to be friendly. Just need them to let me go about my business.
That would be a kindness, Peg says. She turns her head, and it's a strange jerky motion with the bird head on top of hers. If I wasn't unsettled by anything that I saw tonight, that motion would have done it. She says, I have to go. On the rock, a woman wearing a real horse head stands over the place where the man poured the blood. Her tunic is soaked in blood. Her hands run with it. She faces the crowd, but with that massive head, it doesn't seem like she's looking at us. But at some point in the sky, I feel swimmy and feverish from the heat of the bonfire, from the sight of the blood. I'm dreaming, but I'm not. There's murmuring from the people assembled. I can't pick out individual words, but Elizabeth says,
they're saying no one got the shell. She didn't drop a shell this year.
The shell?
For the wish, Elizabeth says in her impatient way. She drops a shell and you get a wish. Probably she dropped it down in Skarmouth and they were too dull to find it.
Who is it? Finn asks Elizabeth, the first thing he's said in a long while.
In the horse head. The mother of all horses. Epona. Soul of Thisbe and those cliffs.
Finn, patient, clarifies. I meant, who is the woman?
Someone with more upfront to look at than you, Elizabeth replies.
Finn's eyes instantly go to the horsewoman's breasts, and Elizabeth laughs, high and wild. I scowl in defense of Finn's virtue, and she gives me a healthy shove.
They're calling for the riders.
They are. The woman with the horse head has gone, though I didn't see her going, and Peg Grattan has climbed the rock and stands in her place. A dozen or so men are gathered around one end of the rock, waiting to go up, and still more are moving restlessly toward the group. I am a small, motionless animal. Elizabeth clucks her tongue.
You can wait if you like. They go up one at a time.
My hands aren't very steady, so I fist them. I watch closely to see what's expected of me. The first rider walks up the natural steps at the end of the rock. It's Ian Privett, who looks older than he is because of his hair, gone grey when he was a boy. He storms across the rock toward Peg Grattan.
I will ride, he tells her formally,
loud enough for us to hear clearly. Then he thrusts out his hand toward her, and she slices his finger with a tiny blade, the motion too fast for me to see it properly. Privett holds his hand out over the rock, and blood must fall, though I'm too far away to see it. He doesn't seem to be in pain. He says,
Ian Privett, Pender, by my blood.
Peg answers in a low voice, not hers, thank you. Then Ian is off the rock, and the next rider is mounting the steps. It's Mutt Malvern, who repeats the process, holding his hand out to let it drip after she's cut it. When he says,
Matthew Malvern, Scarter, by my blood.
He looks out from the rock to find someone in the audience, and his mouth makes a sort of not smile that I'm glad I'm not the recipient of. Again and again, riders step up onto the rock, holding out their hands, giving their names and their horses' names, and again, Peg Grattan thanks them before they go. So many of them. There must be 40. I've seen the race reports in the paper before, and there's never been anywhere near 40 in the final race. What happens to all of them? I imagine I can smell the blood on the rock from here. And still, the riders come up to the top of the rock to have their fingers sliced and to announce their intention to ride. As it gets closer to when I must go up, I am shivering and nervous as can be, but I'm also aware that I'm waiting for Sean Kendrick to step onto the rock. I don't know if it's because he raced me, or because I watched him lose that mare, or because he told me to stay off the beach where no one else would speak to me at all, or merely because his red stallion is the most beautiful horse I've ever seen, but I'm curious about him in a way that puzzles even me. Most of the group has come and gone by the time Sean comes up onto the rock. I barely recognize him. He has blood smeared across both of his sharp cheekbones, and the way he looks is at once striking and disturbing, harsh and godless, wary and predatory, like someone who would climb this rock back when it was a real man whose blood they spilled on it, not just a bowl of sheep's blood. I wonder, suddenly, what Father Mooneyham is doing on this night, if he's sequestered in St. Columbus, praying that the members of his congregation keep their wits about them until tomorrow, and that they won't forget themselves to pagan mare goddesses. But I wonder what sort of goddess our island goddess could possibly be, anyway. Even if she had existed, that she is satisfied by a bowl of animal blood in place of a man. I've seen sheep's blood, and I've seen a dead person, and I know the difference. Sean Kendrick holds out his hand.
I will ride,
he says. And when he says it, I feel heavy, like my feet are being pulled into the rock below me. Peg Grattan slashes his finger. She really doesn't look like Peg Grattan at all, not when she's up there in the light of the bonfire, the shadow of the beak hiding her face. His voice is barely audible.
Sean Kendrick. Cor. By my blood. There's a great roar from the crowd, including from Elizabeth, who I thought was too dignified for such things. But Sean doesn't look up or acknowledge their cheers.
I think I see his lips move again, but it's such a slight movement that I'm not sure. Then he's off the rock.
This is you,
Elizabeth says.
Up with you. Don't forget your name.
As cold as I was a moment before, I'm now blazing hot. I throw my chin up and walk around the rock to where I can step up onto it like the others. It seems wide as the ocean as I walk across it to Peg Grattan. Though the rock must be quite solid, the surface seems to tip and roll as I make my way across it. I can see three different colors of blood under my feet. I keep thinking in my head, I will ride by my blood. I don't want to forget them in my nerves. Now I see Peg Grattan's eyes, bright and piercing beneath the beaked headdress. She looks fierce and powerful. I feel the attention of everybody in Skarmouth, everyone on Thisbe, and all the tourists that the mainland's released. I stand as straight as I can. I will be as fierce as Peg Grattan, even if I don't have her great bird headdress to hide under. I have my name, and that's always been good enough. I stretch out my hand. I wonder how much her little knife will hurt. My voice sounds louder than I expected. I will ride! Peg lifts her blade. I brace myself. No one has flinched, and I refuse to be the first. Wait! Says a voice. Not Peg Grattan's. We both turn our heads. There's Eton, in his sweaty traditional garb, standing at the base of the rock, his head craned back so he can see us. A group of men stands around him, hands in pockets and tucked in vests. Some of them are riders who still hold their hands gingerly so they won't bleed more. Some of them wear traditional scarves, like Eton does. They're frowning. I said it wrong. I came up out of turn. I did something wrong. I can't think of what it would be, but I feel uncertainty chewing on my guts. Eden says, "She can't ride!" My heart falls out of me. Dove! It must be Dove! I should have gotten the piebald mare when I had the chance. "No woman's ridden in the races since they began," he says. "And this isn't going to be the year when that changes." I stare at Eton and the men around him. Something about the way they stand together is familiar, comradely, like a herd of ponies bunched up against the wind, or sheep staring warily out at the collie that means to move them. I'm the outsider, the woman. Of all the things that could stand between me and the races, I can't believe that this will be it. My face flushes. I'm aware that hundreds of people are watching me stand on this rock. But I find my voice anyway. It didn't say anything about that in the rules. I read them, every single one. Eton looks to the man next to him, who licks his lips before saying, "There are rules on paper, and rules too big for paper." It takes me a moment to realize what this means, which is that there really is no rule against it, but they're not going to let me ride anyway. This is like when Gabe and I would play games when we were younger. As soon as I got close to winning, he would change the rules on me. And just like back then, the unfairness of it makes my chest burn. I say, "Then why have rules on paper at all?" "Some things are too obvious to have to write down," says the man next to Eton, who is wearing a very tidy three-piece suit with a scarf in place of the jacket. I can see the neat triangle of the vest, dark grey against white, more clearly than his face. "Come down now," Eton says. There is a third man at the base of the rock where I just climbed up, and he holds his hand up in my direction, as if I'm going to just take it and go back down. I don't move. It's not obvious to me. Eton frowns for half a moment, and then he explains, slowly putting the words together as the explanation comes to him. "The women are the island, and the island keeps us. That's important. But the men are what drive the island into the seabed and keep it from floating out to sea. You can't have a woman on the beach. It reverses the natural order."
So you want to disqualify me because of superstition, I say.
You think ships will run aground because I ride in the races?
Ah, that's putting too fine a point on it.
So it's just me.
You think it's wrong to have me in the races?
Eden's face reminds me of Gabe's, down at the pub, as he looks to the crowd with an incredulous expression. Certain they, too, see how difficult I'm being. The longer I look at him, the more I find to dislike. Does his wife not find his larger lower lip horrifying? Can he not part his hair so it doesn't reveal such a lot of scalp? Does he have to work his chin like that between words? He tells me,
"Don't take it personally now. It's not like that. It's personal to me."
Now they're annoyed. They thought I would just come down at the first whisper of the word no. And now that I haven't, I'm less of a story for later and more of a fight for now. Eden says,
"There are other things you could do in the month of October that will please more people than just you, Kate Connolly. You don't have to ride in the races."
I think about Benjamin Malvern, sitting at our kitchen table, asking what we're willing to do to save the house. I think about how if I step off this rock right now, Gabe will have no reason to stay at all. And no matter how angry I am with him, I can't have that conversation be our last. I think about how it felt to race Sean Kendrick on his unpredictable Kapalishka.
"I have my own reasons for riding," I snap. "Just like every man who climbed onto this rock. Just because I'm a girl doesn't make those reasons any less."
Ian Privett, from a few steps away, says,
"Kate Connolly, who do you see standing beside you? A woman takes our blood. A woman grants our wishes. But the blood on that rock is men's blood, blood of generations. It's not a question of if you want to be up there or not. You don't belong up there. Now stop this. Come down and stop being a child."
Who is Ian Privett to tell me anything? This too reminds me of Gabe telling me to stop being hysterical when I didn't think I was being hysterical at all. I think of Mum on the back of a horse, teaching me to ride, so much a part of the horse herself. They can't tell me I don't belong up here. They might force me off no matter what I say, but they can't tell me I don't belong.
"I'll follow the rules I was given," I say. "I'm not following something unwritten."
"Kate Connolly," says the man in the vest. "There's never been a woman on that beach, and you're wanting us to make this the first year for it? Who are you to ask for that?"
By some unspoken signal, the man, who'd held out his hand for me to come down, starts up the stairs. "They will take me down if I won't come. It's over. I can't really believe that it's over."
"I'll speak for her."
Every face turns to where Sean Kendrick stands, a little apart from the crowd, his arms crossed.
"This island runs on courage, not blood," he says.
His face is turned toward me, but his eyes are on Eton and his group. In the hush after he speaks, I can hear my heart thudding in my ears. I can see they're considering his words. Their faces are clear. They want to be able to ignore him, but they're trying to decide how much weight you give the words of someone who has cheated death in the races so many times. As before, in Thomas Grattan's truck, Sean Kendrick says nothing more. Instead, his silence draws them out, forces them to meet him.
"And you say to let her ride," Eton says, finally. "Despite everything."
"There's no everything," Sean replies.
"Let the sea decide what's right and what's wrong."
There is an agonizingly long pause.
"Then she rides," Eton says.
Around him, there's head shaking, but no one speaks out. Sean's word holds.
"Give your blood, girl."
Peg Grattan doesn't wait for me to stretch my hand out any farther. She snakes forward and slices my finger, and instead of pain, there's a searing heat that runs all the way up to my shoulder. The blood wells and drips freely onto the rock.
I have that feeling again like I did before, when Sean Kendrick was up here. My feet are rooted to the rock, part of the island, and I'm grown up out of it. The wind rips at my hair, pulling it out of my hairband and whipping the strands across my face. The air smells like the ocean, breaking up across the shore. I lift my chin again and say, Kate Connolly, Dove, by my blood. I find Sean Kendrick in the crowd again. He's turned as if he's going, but he looks over his shoulder at me. I hold his gaze. I feel like everyone in the crowd is watching this moment, like to hold Sean Kendrick's eye is to promise something, or to get into something I'm unsure of, but I don't look away. By their blood! Let the races begin, Peg Ratton says to the night and to the crowd, but they aren't watching her. We have our riders! Let the races begin! Sean Kendrick holds my gaze a second longer, and then he strides away from the crowd. 2 weeks until the races. Everything starts tonight. I can feel it in my heart.
Chapter 33 Sean. The next morning finds the island ghostly quiet, though the frenzy of last night seemed to suggest that training would begin in earnest today. The stables are still, the roads silent. I'm happy for it. I have a lot to get done in the next 24 hours. I cast a glance toward the sky. A dimpled quilt of cloud hides the sun, and below it, smaller clouds race by in a hurry to get on their way. I'll know better how long I have until the storm gets here once I see the ocean. In the eerie quiet of the morning, I turn out the youngest of the thoroughbreds for a bit of exercise and grass before the weather gets poor, and then I gather my supplies to take down to the shore, 2 buckets and my pockets sunk full of weak magic. As I'm about to head out, I hear a voice. So, you're not a churchgoer, then? Good morning, Mr. Holly, I reply. He's in what I think they must consider Sunday finery in America. A white V-necked sweater and light jacket over creased khaki pants. He looks like he might be ready to pose for one of the mainland paper's society pages. Good morning, Holly returns. He peers inside my buckets and rears back with a wince. They're full of coarse rank manure, and even I have a hard time getting used to the odor. Sweet Mary and Coca-Cola, that's hard to bear. Seeing that I'm struggling to open the gate without setting down my buckets, he opens it for me and closes it behind me, following amiably. So you're not a believer? I believe in the same thing they believe in, I say, with a jerk of my chin toward town and St. Columba's. I just don't believe you can find it in a building. The ground is soft and scented lightly with horse manure. As I start down the roads toward the shoreline that borders most of Malvern's pastures, it's on the opposite side of the island from the racing beach, and while there are still cliffs, they're lower and more uneven, with uncertain beaches and more places for the ocean and the creatures who live in it to crawl onto shore. Holly trots to catch up with me and slides one of the bucket handles out of my hand and into his. He grunts at the weight, but says nothing else. What are you doing? I ask. Looking for God, Holly says, matching my stride. If you say he's out here, I'll take a gander. I'm not certain he'll find his sort of God sharing this work with me, but I don't protest. It's a bit of a walk to the cliffs, and having company might not be terrible. As we get farther away from the protection of the stable-yard buildings, the wind becomes more insistent, gusting across the fields unchecked. The only signs of civilization are the stone walls that mark Malvern's pastures. They long predate Malvern's herds. This is a Thisbe many have forgotten. Holly, to his credit, walks in silence for several long minutes before he asks, What is it we're doing, exactly? Storm's coming, I answer. Already it'll be worse out at sea, and that will drive the horses in. By horses, you mean... Again, he pauses carefully before attempting a pronunciation. The Kapil Ishka. I nod. And drives him in where, exactly? Whoa, and hey! This last exclamation is because we've just gotten to a high point, where we can see the ocean and the area around us. The land is all perilous, low cliffs, cracked and cut deeply into the green, pasture and then suddenly empty air and then pasture again. Below us and beyond us, the sea is white caps and foam and black rocks like teeth. A busy sea. Tomorrow will be hell, I think. I give Holly a long moment to drink in the sight before I answer his question. Drives them inland. If they're in the shallow water around the island, they'd sooner be on land than facing those rocks and current. And Kapil Ishka, newly on land, isn't something you'd like to see. Because they're hungry? I tip my bucket to allow a bit of the foul cargo to spill out onto the path, then continue picking my way along. Because they're hungry, yes. But they're also uncertain, and that makes them worse. So you're dumping crap to mark territory. If they come on shore here, I want them to think they'll meet Kor, and not Benjamin Malvern's broodmares, finishes Holly. We work in silence then, marking the places of easy access along the high ground first, and then working our way down. Finally, there's only the rocky beach to attend to. Perhaps you'd like to stay up for this, I suggest. I can't guarantee his safety next to the water. The sea is already tumultuous and dangerous, and there's nothing to say that there won't already be Kapil Ishka down there. Malvern would be displeased if I lost one of his buyers 2 days after losing a horse the same way. Holly nods as if he understands me, but when I start down the path, he comes with me. This is a small bravery, and I respect him for it. I trade my empty bucket for the one he holds, and he massages his palm where the bucket handle pressed into it. Here at the base of the path, the best of the shoreline is made of rocks the size of my fist, and the rest is boulders and pieces of the cliff that fell short of the water. Before me, the ocean stretches longingly toward my feet. It smells like dead things off at sea. If I were trying to catch another horse, I say, this would be a good time to do it. The surf has found its way into a shallow pool by our feet, and George Holly inexplicably dips his fingers into the water. The pool is full of opportunistic anemones that stretch their tentacles out in the surf, and urchins that would cut you if you stood on them, and crabs that are too small to make a good meal. Warmer than I expected, Holly remarks. Why aren't you trying to catch another horse then, since you lost one the other day? The truth is that there's precious little reason to catch another Kapil Ishka now that Mutt Malvern has put himself on Skarta. There's not much reason to have Idana either at this point. I don't need another horse. I have Kor. Holly prods one of the urchins with a stone. How do you know there isn't a faster horse than Kor out there, waiting to be caught? I think of the piebald and her tremendous speed. Maybe there is. I don't need to know. I'm not tempted, I say. Of course, it's not just the winning. I don't know how to explain that I know his heart better than anyone's, and he mine. I don't need another horse. I close my mouth and pick my way to the other access point on this otherwise inaccessible beach. Drawing a handful of salt out of my pocket, I spit on it before throwing it across the mouth of the other path. I tip some of Kor's manure out. Then I head back up the path without another word. Holly follows me, and though I don't turn around, I hear his voice clearly. It's just that he's not yours. I'm not certain I want to have this conversation. It's not that he's not mine. It's that he's Benjamin Malvern's. That doesn't make any sense. It makes all the sense in the world on this island. Thisby is defined by things that are Malvern's and things that aren't. It matters like this. I belong to Malvern. You don't. So, freedom. I stop what I'm doing and regard him. Holly stands there below me on the path, gazing up, looking incredibly well-kept and domesticated in his